It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. Alaska's climate can be unforgiving, which, for those of us who love to spend time outdoors, can be part of the challenge, the reward, and a reason why we love it here. For the military, the challenge can be even tougher, and usually is not recreational. And most service members are assigned here, though they often come back by choice. On today's show, we're talking about Arctic warriors and the skills they learn and practice. We have two officers in the studio whose military training has helped make them help them make it through Alaska's harshest weather. One was on a caribou hunt on the North Slope when the weather took a dangerous turn. The other led a successful Denali ascent over the summer. What does a military teach about surviving outdoors? We'll get into that question on today's show. And my two guests are Major Matt Miller of the Air Force. He's a pilot, flies the F-22 with the 90th Fighter Squadron. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
And I don't want to be overly formal, but I think I should probably call you Major Miller since both of my guests today are named Matt. My other guest is Captain Matt Hickey of the U.S. Army, and he led that Denali expedition that happened this year. Thanks for being with us, Major.
It's great to be
Captain
here.
Captain Hickey. So purpose of the Army, conquering Mount McKinley, right? I mean, that's not doesn't necessarily seem like what we normally think of you guys doing, but there was a purpose behind this. There was something you were trying to prove in a way.
Yeah, it's definitely not your standard mission that the Army gets. But being part of U.S. Army Alaska, which is the Army's preeminent cold weather unit, we were tasked with the objective of a Mount McKinley expedition. And the Commanding General of U.S. Army Alaska asked us to test some of the gear that soldiers are issued here in U.S. Army Alaska and put to use our training. Over the years here, we've kind of gone away a little bit from our cold weather and our Arctic skills to focus on the war on terror, and this was an opportunity to get back to that. So over the course of a few months, we selected some soldiers, gave them the equipment that every soldier's given up here in Alaska, and put them through the training that every soldier has to go through.
Well, how many were in your team?
There were two teams, actually. I was in charge of an 8-man team, and another team of 7 soldiers. One was from Fort Wainwright up north, and the other one was here in Anchorage at J-Bear. And we conducted the similar training and prepared for the ascent.
Uh-huh. So I hate to cut right to the end, but I'm dying of curiosity. Did you make it to the top?
Yes. So both teams were successful because everybody came home in one piece with no injuries, which ultimately is the main goal when you go out there.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes you don't have a say whether you're going to make the summit or not. The mountain's ultimately in control, and you need to be aware of that.
Mm-hmm.
My team of 8, we were fortunate enough to get up and down the mountain to the summit. All 8 members made it on June 14th. We were very fortunate to do so. But along the way, we were able to use military equipment, our clothing and equipment, and put to use our training to ultimately endure and survive in the world's harshest environment, which when you're in the military, you have to do quite often. It's not a choice. It's your mission. And so unlike people who go about in Alaska recreationally, they can choose not to go out if it's a little bit too cold or if it's snowing or the wind's blowing. The military has to go out. And in a way, being on McKinley, once you fly in and get to the mountain, you don't have a choice but to survive. And that's what we did.
It seems to me that it's also, in terms of the training exercise, part of what you need to learn is a courage and the ability to face obstacles, bravely and as a team and cohesion and all that in the face of difficulties and obstacles. And here's a real one it's not like there's somebody creating it for you. It's actually there, right?
Yeah. It's, I've mentioned on a number of occasions that there might not be two things more similar than the military and mountaineering. Because in mountaineering, you are heavily reliant on another for your survival and your success, just like you are during military operations, especially in combat. And we were very, very prepared for what we faced there because we know how to operate as a team. And we kind of share that in mountaineering. You call it the brotherhood of the rope. And then when you're deployed or in the military, it's, your brothers in arms. And it was a pretty easy transition for us to go from military training to mountaineering because we're used to relying on each other. And it wasn't difficult for us. Mm-hmm. And while the conditions around us might have been extremely challenging, we didn't have to worry about somebody not being there to support us if you're having a rough day, which oftentimes you will, whether you're in a combat environment, we're on a challenging mountain like Denali. And ultimately, I think that's why we were tremendously successful in a challenging year in which only about 30% of the climbers were able to make it to the top.
Yeah. I want to hear a lot more about that, but I want to talk first also to my other guest, Major Matt Miller, who flies the F-22. That's right. That's a sort of airplane that's the Snoopy and Red Baron type fighting, right? And
yeah, upgraded just slightly.
A little bit, yeah. A little bit faster, right? And you guys really have, I mean, you're operating in extreme conditions. You hope not to, like, fall out of the sky, but you have to be ready for that, right?
Yeah, and the challenge for us in Alaska flying is that, you know, 99% of our training is focused on what we do in the jet, whereas, you know, in the unlikely event that one of us had to get out, we could find ourselves in the exact same place that somebody has spent months training to be in. We're there by surprise, kind of, oftentimes with just what we are wearing and the limited amount of stuff that we have with us in the jet that comes down.
Yeah, and I think most Alaskans know about the bunny boots, which are the greatest invention of all time. You know, like, if you could stand, I've actually stood on the Arctic ice pack in bunny boots, you know, in freezing cold weather. You never get cold. It's almost
feet
impossible.
Are still sweating.
Yeah, yeah. So, you don't wear those when you're flying, do you? Or?
The bunny boots are a little bit too big, and yeah. we've tested a lot of different boots over the years.
Are those like old technology that's no longer used?
Yeah, we've got really good boots right now that are, you know, waterproof, heavy grain, thin slit on the inside, and a little bit more manageable in terms of, you lose a little bit of feel of the airplane in bunny boots.
Yeah, I tried.
We've tried.
My heater broke in my car, my truck, and I was driving the highway and trying to drive my bunny boots. And, you know, I tried to hit the clutch and I hit the brake, you know, spinning, you know, 360s. Yeah, I could see you wouldn't want to fly in those.
It's amazing. Even something as simple as that can still give feedback or not give feedback case of the bunny boots.
So, so what kind of gear do you have in the airplane? For you know, survival?
Like I said, most of it is what you put on your body. So depending on the temperatures of all the, you know, essentially we'll use the lowest temperature expected in a 24-hour period over the entire area that we're flying. Typically, that will be up to the north, cold around the Fairbanks, Eielson region and the Alaska range there that we're flying over. So some 14,000, you know, foot peaks and stuff like that. So we'll dress appropriately. And what that means is once we go into our life support section, we're putting on a lot of cold weather clothing. So we'll layer all the way up, boots, outerwear, gloves shoved in pockets. And then I actually have a big heavy hat that I will put underneath my jacket. Mm-hmm. We essentially look like the Michelin man stepping out to the airplane. I mean, you can barely move. And then you wedge yourself into the cockpit and, it's a little bit uncomfortable to dress up. You're usually sweating by the time you get in all that gear. But then, you know, it's not about that. It's about, you know, dress to egress and what it would be like and what do you want to have with you on the ground should you end up there.
Right.
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned the the Michelin man and the bunny boots because the Army, U.S. Army Alaska here has a unit that is an airborne unit, 4th Brigade, 25th Infantry. And it's a brigade combat team that has to jump out of airplanes into an Arctic environment. And recently they've been able to jump into literally the Arctic, I mean the Arctic Circle. And occasionally, if the temperatures warrant it, not in an emergency case like you might have in the Air Force, intentionally, they will come out of the airplane wearing bunny boots with with the marshmallow suit on or the Michelin man suit because it is just that cold. So you'll come out of a C-17 or a C-130 that the Air Force flies, and so it's a joint mission, and these soldiers, these paratroopers, will exit the aircraft with all of their gear to go survive and operate in the Arctic environment. So,
well, if it's way below zero on the ground, I can't imagine how cold it is when they're actually floating down on the ground on a parachute.
Yeah, well, nobody really takes the time to actually measure the temperature. Your adrenaline's going a little bit because you're happy that your parachute just happened to open, but Yeah, it's certainly cold, and by the time you hit the ground, you're happy that you have the bunny boots on and the whole gamut. Wow. There.
And I don't know if you remember, this was back in, I want to say 07 or 08. There was an F-15 that crashed and bailed out in, I believe it was June. So June, normal temperatures, even, you know, mm-hmm. warm in the interior. And he got out up at altitude and was unable. He wasn't carrying any of the, you know, standard Arctic type of gear with him because it was summertime. But his hands were frozen enough just from the ride down that he didn't have dexterity for over 15, 20 minutes. So wow. he kind of just had to wait for everything wow. to thaw out once he hit the ground.
It's really operating at the absolute extremes of what human beings can deal with. And
absolutely.
It's really amazing that what you guys are able to do. And so many more questions. It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Woolforth. I have two guests with me. You were just hearing from Matt Miller, who is a major in the U.S. Air Force and flies the F-22. And Captain Matt Hickey of the Army is with me as well. And Captain Hickey, we were talking about the Denali expedition. One of the things that I think is, you know, back in the old days, military equipment, you could buy it sort of surplus, and it was tough, durable, heavy, not what your typical outdoorsman or certainly mountaineer would want
right,
to use.
Right.
Whereas the stuff that you would buy at REI is all designed to be super light and, you know, how does...
Flashy, Gore-Tex, European.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So how does your equipment compare to what civilian equipment is now?
Well, that's a great question because just prior to the show, Major Miller and I here were just talking about the equipment. The Army, especially the conventional Army, and not a special operations unit, has the, I guess, the unfortunate disadvantage of having to field a lot of equipment for many soldiers for a reasonable price, and that's kind of what we owe the taxpayers. We can't excessively purchase things because it just wouldn't be the right thing to do. But we also need to have the best gear possible to get the job done. And there have been questions over the years whether the equipment that we get up here in a cold weather environment in the Arctic is suitable for what our job might be. And our expedition to Denali essentially proved that what we are given is suitable enough. But what we did find was that it's heavier, it's bulkier, and might not look as nice as what some of these fancy mountaineers or alpinists mm-hmm. are toting out there in the hills. But it gets the job done. And it's easier to use, and it's uniform, and that's mm-hmm. what we need in the military. And it needs to be fielded to a lot of guys, and it needs to last a long time. And usually, if it's going to last a long time, it's going to be a little bit heavier, because it needs to be of a material that's a little bit thicker.
Well, your bush rat guy who's out there and doesn't have a lot of money is going to be using military surplus gear and making it last a long time, and it works.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. That's why you'll see it at surplus stores, because it lasts a long time. And it's been tested before it's even mm-hmm. fielded to the troops, and when it's fielded to the troops, it's tested. I mean, if you give somebody an 18 to 20-year-old soldier who just came up from the South and give him some equipment that he needs to use in an Arctic environment, and he'll find a way to break it. If you thought it was unbreakable, he'll find a way to break it. And if it still doesn't break, you know you got the right equipment. It's a challenge. It really is. I mean, the environment provides an incredible challenge. But we've been fortunate enough that people have made the right decisions over the years to give us the right equipment. But it's an ongoing process. I mean, the people are inventing new things all the time. And the Army wants to be, especially up here in Alaska, we want to be on the front end of that to get the newest gear.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Now, you guys are outdoors, just recreationally, you spend time
right.
outdoors, both of you. Do you have, like, your civilian stuff you keep at home and then your military stuff, or do you use
Yeah, well, we are about to embark on this expedition. Me and a few guys on the team that do go out and, uh-huh. and ski and climb on our own are... We're joking about, man, if we were going on our own expedition, our packs would weigh about 20 less pounds, and we'd look a lot better, and yeah. you know, maybe we'd get a date coming off the mountain or something like that, because wearing camouflage and you know, the marshmallow suit isn't exactly the flashiest thing. But yeah, there are comparisons that you can draw, but that makes it better, because you know what the differences are going to be, and you can mm-hmm. you know the price differences, and mm-hmm. you know what you need to get the job done, as opposed to what you just want.
Right.
You know, you're using your mission essential things, as opposed to, well, that looks nice and flashy coming off
yeah.
the shelf.
So you Captain Miller, you know, Major Miller, I just keep saying that. You fly this supersonic jet at work, and then when you go home, you fly like 110 miles an hour, and you're...
I wish I got 110 mile an hour in that thing. Yeah,
you can hover at, what, like 28 miles an hour in that
thing? I spent a lot of money slowing that thing down to about 80 knots.
Okay. And this is a...
big tires and big gear and big prop. Super Cub. Yeah, uh-huh. You bet. And along the same lines with the equipment use, what I said before, when, you know, 99% of our training is all focused on what we do in the air, and we spend some time with the equipment, obviously we don't use it in the same way. So our aircrew flight equipment troops actually encourage us to take the stuff in our, you know, that we would expect to have with us in the ground, and take that out to the field with us recreationally to get familiar with it. Mm-hmm. So the first time you're unwrapping the contents isn't when you need it in a life-saving sort of environment.
So when you go hunting, you can take along some of that stuff and just try
go,
it out.
Yeah, go ahead and bring the GPS with you so you know how it works. Go ahead and, you know, bring the, you know, the safety kit with you, the medical kit with you, because mm-hmm. it's all very... Obviously, space and weight is even more critical, because you don't even have a pack full. You've got a very small, you know, half a briefcase full of stuff that you can fit in there. And it's right. It's all very vital, you know.
Well, what do you think of that stuff? I mean, would you be confident if you like had to ditch with that stuff in the wintertime?
Absolutely. I would. And just to backtrack quick, I got my first assignment to Alaska, and I had no idea. It was my second choice, and my best friend at the time, his first choice was Alaska. I wanted to go to England. We both received our second choice.
You got to switch,
sort of looked at each other and went, I don't know what's going on, but somebody knew something that we didn't.
Sounds like a military story. So where did you come from?
Illinois originally. Okay. And I went straight to one of the other instructors in the unit, and I said, I just got Alaska. I have no idea what goes on up there. Please tell me. They said, well, there's hunting and fishing and camping and hiking. And I said, that sounds great. I don't do any of it.
Really?
Go to the second instructor. I say, all right, what's going on? What's up in Alaska? Oh, fishing, camping, hunting, hiking. I said, okay, I got it. So I came up here knowing that I was going to get into all of that stuff. Uh-huh. And so embraced it and now love it and can't imagine doing anything else.
And you've been here for a while now.
With the two assignments, I'm going on 6 years in the state. So yeah, I've been very, very fortunate in that respect. And I told my wife that if I ever got stationed in Alaska again, I'd buy a Super Cub. And you... Sort of thinking they wouldn't send me here again.
But hoping
that they would. And then I told her, well, I told you I had to buy one. So.
And it could take you basically anywhere you want to go.
Yeah. I flew it up from Illinois at a blazing 60 knots ground speed with just my dad and I. Wow. It took about a week.
Wow. So Matt Hickey, tell me about your story of it. It sounds like you probably already had some mountaineering skills before you got into this, or
yeah, a little bit. I do quite a bit on my own now. I'm originally from St. Paul, Minnesota, and so kind of
it could be colder down there.
Born and bred in the cold land there.
But flat.
Yeah, so I like to say I honed my mountaineering skills on the flats before I took them to the hills. You know, I grew up playing ice hockey and spent a lot of time outside, and kind of unbeknownst to myself, really, when you grow up in a cold weather environment, you learn how to stay warm, especially if you're recreational about it. And I didn't really pick up the mountaineering and the skiing bug until I went out to college, and I was out in New York, and started to kind of get out in the hills in the wintertime. And realized that this might be something I want to continue to do. So over the years, I've been able to go on a number of expeditions or longer trips down to South America or Africa, over in the Himalaya and in the European Alps, and and then up here in Alaska, ultimately, which is my favorite spot to climb because you don't need to go very far to have extreme challenge. But along the lines of what Major Miller was just talking about how the unknowns when you come up to Alaska, how to dress, what to expect. I mean, the Army sees that... every time a new soldier arrives.
Well, that's what I was going to say, is that if you've got these soldiers coming from all over the country,
right.
or they've served in the desert,
mm-hmm.
and a big part of getting by in a cold environment is psychological, right?
Yes.
It's like not being afraid of the cold.
Well, so some people take it for granted, such, you know, maybe not myself, but other people who recreate outside and they sort of know how to incorporate themselves into an environment such as Alaska. But take a new recruit, 18 years old, maybe from Georgia or maybe just from, you know, New York City, and all he does is he, you know, he's not outside active all that time. And then he finds out he's stationed at Fort Wainwright and by Fairbanks, who comes up here to Anchorage.
Mommy! It's,
yeah, exactly. I mean, imagine that. I should have done this. But the Army does an incredible job training these guys. And U.S. Army Alaska has what's called the Northern Warfare Training Center. It's up near Delta Junction, and they're home to a number of cold weather survival courses and a few mountaineering courses, but they are the Army's experts when it comes to cold weather operations. And so what they do with between their instructors and some other people who work at the school is they have courses and curricula that they teach there, and they also incorporate it down at the two bases here we have in the state, and they put people through training. And some of those courses are known as cold weather leaders course and cold weather orientation course, and they teach guys the basics, how to dress and how to manage your temperature. And that just because it's really cold outside, you're not going to be frozen. And it's kind of a crawl, walk, run process where you can't take care of others before you take care of yourself. And you can't take care of a group before you take care of your buddy. And you can't go fight a war before you can just survive in the environment. And so it's a really regimented process of learning how to survive first before you can learn how to operate. And then you can learn how to successfully conduct an operation and be successful. And that all starts at the Northern Warfare Training Center and is pushed out then onto the units that are stationed up here in U.S. Army Alaska. And then really also to some of our allies and partners across the world will come to the Northern Warfare Training Center to learn how to survive in extreme environments. And so before you know it, you'll have a 20-year-old kid who grew up in Texas surmounting Mount McKinley, as I had on my team this past year, who had never seen snow. And then before he knew it, he was standing at 20,320 feet, and he's suddenly a self-proclaimed expert. So yeah. We may have got to reel him in a little bit, but hey, I was like that at one point too. So
amazing.
It's a great process that we have here.
And how did you personally develop your skills in this? Was it did you learn them from the Army, or did you sort of learn them on your own and then transfer them?
Well, a little bit
career?
Of both. A lot of trial and error. I purchased a book called Freedom of the Hills, which is your standard mountaineering book, and put it in my pack, went out with some new equipment like an ice axe and some crampons and tried crawling up some frozen waterfall in New York, slipped, fell, went down about 50 feet, was still alive, and said, hey, if I could survive that, I can do it. So I looked up self-arrest real quick in the book and figured I probably should have known that.
Oh, I see. Wow.
And so I told myself I'd read more before I tried things as opposed to try things and then read it. But
I'm glad you're still here.
Yeah, exactly. And a lot of it is trial and error, but personally, I've done some of both. I mean, I've attended both cold weather courses that the Army offers, mountaineering courses. I was fortunate enough to go over to India, spend 4 months over there at their high altitude warfare school, and help instruct a little bit at that course and learn a little bit what they have to offer. And then in my free time, and I try to get out. I work a little bit with the Mountaineering Club of Alaska, which is a great spot for anybody, whether you're in the military or not, to just get some basic skills. And then I learn a lot from local Alaskans that just have a lot of great experience.
Mm-hmm. Major Miller, you were talking about coming from Indiana, didn't know much of anything about outdoors. Now you're flying your Super Cub around and doing hunting and doing all kinds of stuff. Did you sort of like learn from buddies, or how did you pick up your outdoor skills?
Yeah. So the first thing I'll talk about is the first course we go through, land survival down in Fairchild Air Force Base near Spokane, Washington. And it's interesting. They have the school all year round. And you either get the winter or the summer, which you can imagine in the forest mountains of eastern Washington is very different. I was fortunate enough to go in March when there were 3 feet of snow on the ground.
Oh, wow.
And it was the coldest I've ever been in my life. I was not personally prepared for that week of not eating, tramping around in snowshoes, mm-hmm. building fires in the snow, et cetera, et cetera. But
through
that week, you know, learning little by little, using the equipment provided the correct way, listening to the instructor, sort of started getting a feel for it towards the end, you know, trapping squirrels. And again, it was sort of the, we're never going to catch squirrels with these little wire things. What are we doing out here? And then the next morning we have seven of them. And I said, well, that's great. Now what?
you know? You got to eat them.
Well, there was a guy in the group with us who was from Kentucky who field dressed those squirrels and nothing flat. And,
wow.
And we were full that night, you know? So it was very interesting.
So this is kind of like you're pushed out of the wild wilderness to survive. Just go survive.
Yeah, you bet. Wow. For about a week, and it's a little bit of everything, mm-hmm. a little bit of mountaineering, a little bit of signal building. Mm-hmm. It's generally focused around downed air crew, how to land nav, and how to make it to a spot to get you out of that situation. So mm-hmm. it's really focused on the kind of the survival element of it, not the conquer element mm-hmm. of it so much. And then I find it interesting, the Army calls it, you know, they've got their Northern Warfare Training Center, which I would assume going into that, I would know exactly what I'm getting myself into. We call it Cool School up at Eielson Air Force Base. And that's basically our Arctic survival. And the interesting thing about that is I was, because of the gear up here that was specifically built for surviving in these conditions, I was so much more comfortable mm-hmm. during Arctic survival than I was during land survival, mm-hmm. you know, which, I had a nice fire. I was, you know, in my t-shirt in 0 degree weather because I knew how to handle, you know, workloads, rest, work cycles, what, you know, all the things that they teach you up here versus being brand new at it and just thrown out into the woods in the snow, down in Washington. So,
It's really interesting. I think the military must be the biggest outdoor education outfit in the country by far. And it sounds like you guys got some really good stuff. We're going to take a break and come back. And I got so many more questions for the second half. Both of these guys have done some pretty amazing outdoor stuff. Major Miller had an adventure caribou hunting where they got stuck out for a while. Captain Hickey went to the top of Mount McKinley. I got a lot more questions about that. And I also want to talk about how the military is reorienting after all these years of warfare in the Middle East and coming sort of back to the roots in Alaska and in the mission that's oriented more towards our climate. But first, we're going to take a quick break and talk about all that when we come back. In a forested area outside Fairbanks, the U.S. Army operates a remote facility where it trains men and women in the cold. In mountainous environments. We were just hearing about it. It's called the Northern Warfare Training Center. And our producer, Monica Gokey, visited last fall while an elite unit of Army Rangers were in town. I'm Charles Wolforth. Stay with us as Outdoor Explorer continues.
Staff Sergeant Michael O'Brien looks on as Private First Class John Carmel readies his rope system to ascend a 50-foot rock face next to a waterfall.
Okay, what's the difference between this rope and this rope? Which one's for your waist and which one's for your foot?
This one's for my waist. Okay. Be for my foot.
So the shorter ones for your waist, the longer ones? Okay.
Carmel has only been an Army Ranger for about a month. He says coming to the middle of cold, wet Alaska for training is exactly the kind of thing he signed up for.
I love it so far.
When it's Carmel's turn to head up, he'll have to shift his weight between two loops of cord to shimmy up the climbing rope.
Right.
It's a new skill for him.
What's the distance you want to keep between these two prusiks?
About a fist.
This width, right? What are you going to do when you get to 8 to 10 feet?
Tie a safety knot, figure eight.
Okay, go ahead and ascend.
The Rangers here are an elite unit of Army Special Operations Forces. For 2 weeks in August, the Georgia-based Rangers tested themselves against the rigors of the Alaskan interior. The facility here is called the Northern Warfare Training Center at Black Rapids. It offers crash courses in alpine and glacier travel, cold weather survival, and high-altitude operations. Back on the rock, Private First Class Carmel has just finished his ascent and successful rappel down the slick rock face.
How was it?
It was fun.
You kind of killed it, like once you got up off the ground.
Yeah, once you get used to doing it, it's fun.
Carmel, like a lot of the guys here, is a man of few words. One of the Army PR guys chalks it up to Ranger culture. Be quiet and let your actions do the talking. Across a small creek, another group of Rangers is doing a basic climbing and rappelling exercise.
all you got 3 points. If you trust that left foot hold, go ahead and stand up on it. That gives you more freedom to use your right foot.
Staff Sergeant Joel Rockhill has already been up the rock wall and back again. Since becoming a Ranger 9 years ago, he's been to airborne school, jumping out of planes and stuff. But scaling a rain-slicked 50-foot rock wall still gets his adrenaline going.
I mean, it was... I'm scared of heights, not going to lie, but it's pretty difficult.
Rockhill says coming to Alaska for cold weather warfare training is a change of pace for the group. In his time with the Rangers, he's been deployed 9 times, which doesn't leave a lot of time for exercises like this one.
Okay, it's a unique training opportunity. We haven't really got to do a lot of this stuff because of the wars. But so now coming out here and doing this, getting exposed to the different environment, obviously different than Iraq and Afghanistan, and really kind of starting to prep for future whatever, it's really good.
With fewer deployments on the horizon as national military focus shifts away from the Middle East, trainings like this one, Rockhill says, help keep the Rangers a close-knit group.
You know, obviously we get new guys a lot, but, you know, you build that cohesiveness through, you know, training and different situations happen on deployment and other things, you know. A lot of these guys, at least, you know, peers of mine, you know, we still kind of stay pretty close-knit, you know, hang out on the weekends and such.
Getting to travel to Alaska together and rough it in the mountains, Rockhill says, isn't a bad way to spend 2 weeks with your friends. From Black Rapids, I'm Monica Gokey.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on KSKA Anchorage. The program repeats tonight at 9 o'clock on FM 91.1. Connect with Outdoor Explorer anytime. Download podcasts and see what's coming up on future programs by going to our website at alaskapublic.org.
It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth, and today we're talking about what the military knows about outdoor survival. It's a really interesting topic because I think most of us, if we know anything about doing stuff outdoors, learn it from our dads or from our buddies or just through trial and error. And the two officers I have in the room with me today actually got training and know what they're talking about, which has been really interesting.
Well, maybe.
At least they're doing a good job of sounding like it anyway. Army Captain Matt Hickey led a successful expedition to Denali to the top this summer, and he's going to tell us more about that. And Air Force Major Matt Miller flies F-22s, and his military background came in handy during a hunting trip that had some excitement, some adventure this coming summer. And I want you to tell us about that, Matt. Where were you and kind of what happened?
Yep. So there was a group of six of us, and we took 2 Super Cubs, 2-place airplanes, and then drew straws. I didn't have to draw one since I was flying a Cub, but the other two drove up north through to the top up north of the Brooks Range.
Up the Delta
and,
Highway.
Up the Delta Highway, through the Brooks, north of the Brooks Range, like I said, on a caribou hunt. We ended up probably about 120 miles east of the highway on a ridgeline up there.
It takes a long time to get there in a Super Cub.
It does.
Especially when you're used to going like 1,000 miles an hour.
Yeah, I can do it in 30 minutes in the F-22, and it was a little over 10 hours in the Super Cub plus stops. Anyway, we sat down on a ridge line. First time I'd done that. I have to mention, you know, the community up here, aviation is so great, and so tight knit. And, a lot of this, you know, a lot of, we've been talking about the military, you know, training, helping us out in these things. But, I learned a lot of this stuff from the aviation community here in Alaska. And we know a lot of, guys, and even military to civilian, partnerships lead us to discussing a lot of things about, aviation Alaska in general. So that's been really nice. I've gotten a lot of help from guys up here
that
know.
Especially some of the bush stuff, like landing on
all of the bush, all of the bush stuff. Yeah,
so. I'm sure they don't have that in a military manual.
No, that's not really anywhere. So a lot of us have appreciated a lot of that that help and that relationship. But
well, I know that Alaska aviators appreciate the military because you guys are like the backup, and mm-hmm. so many people up here came in the military and learned their skills there.
Yeah, you bet. But you know, even so much as, all right, I know how to get up there at 45,000 feet, but how do I do it at 1,000 feet? You know, mm-hmm. maybe not Attigan Pass. Let's try Anaktuvuk Pass. Uh-huh. That kind of stuff was really great. Safety is the main thing.
Right,
the same thing as the Denali Expedition. Yeah. A successful hunt for me up to the Brooks Range is everybody coming home alive in one piece, preferably mm-hmm. the airplane in one piece, but even that can get fixed. But we sat down on the ridgeline, like I said, had a very successful hunt. You know, the very next day we had four caribou all taken care of and ready to go. And as you can imagine, limited weather reporting capability in the mm-hmm. Brooks Range when the nearest humans are, 50 miles away from you. What we didn't quite, what was not forecast was the weather that rolled in that night. So middle of August, weather rolled in and we wake up and on top of the ridgeline, we could see that it was beautiful outside. We were stationing out of Kavik River Camp up there, which was about 50 miles away from this ridge that we were on. And we could see down at the lower elevations that the fog had rolled off of the Arctic Ocean and made it all the way to the Brooks Range, essentially. We were unable to, by sat phone, get in touch with Sue Akins, the owner of Kavik River Camp, to figure out what exactly she was seeing for weather. But we decided it was a nice day, had the fuel for it. We attempted to make it back there with mostly people and, some of the caribou meat. Mm-hmm. We took off. We made it about halfway, and we realized there was no landing at Kavik right now. Mm-hmm. Turn back around, land back on the ridgeline. And what proceeded over the next 3 to 4 days was a cycle of morning ground fog, afternoon ridgeline in the clouds. We went from sunny skies in the morning, beautiful flying weather, but we can't do anything with it because where we're going is fogged in, to now we can't take off because we're actually in the cloud, and so anyway, again, that persisted for a couple of days.
So you were just sitting on top of this ridge.
We were, and so the tie-in with the military type mm-hmm. of stuff is five out of the six of us were military members, and the sixth was former military. So planned for all such contingencies, we immediately started, rationing the food. Now I say rationing food, and we had 400 pounds of caribou up there, so we weren't wanting, I should say. But the carbohydrates, the sugars, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Just formulating a game plan to preserve fuel that we had for cooking. We had plenty of water where we were, mm-hmm. Et cetera, and start not moving around as much, expending mm-hmm. as much energy. On the fourth day, we were lucky enough. The weather broke enough. We got a hold of Sue on the phone, and the weather was good enough. So we took four of us, made it to Kavik, landed safely, offloaded. And by the time we were able to unload and call via sat phone the guys back on the ridge, it had changed that fast. And they said,
socked
you can't make
again,
it.
Huh?
We're socked in. And we're like, all right, sit tight. So we left. There were two guys up there. And then, again, what happened next was just we knew it could happen, which is why we had what we had. So we had mm-hmm. hats, gloves, layers, mm-hmm. food, fuel, et cetera. We were ready for it. We weren't expecting it. All of a sudden, they started talking around camp about the snowstorm that was happening.
Oh, wow. Like,
it's August 16th. What do you mean snowstorm? The next morning, we woke up, and there was about 3 to 4 inches where we were down at the camp, mm-hmm. and up on the ridgeline, it was closer to 6 or 7.
Wow.
Again, the tie-in to the aviation community. Mm-hmm. We were there with another Super Cub pilot that helped us out. We broke out maps, took a look at everything, and he told us of another landing strip that he knew that was within a couple miles of where they were at, on top of this ridgeline, that they would be able to essentially get down off of the ridgeline so we could stop the, because it was the same thing now in reverse from Kavik, where we would wake up and be fogged in and they would call and they would say, it's beautiful here. Sorry, we can't do anything
besides,
about
you don't
it.
Really want to land your wheeled plane in 6 or 7 inches of snow on top of a ridgeline, right?
More about that. Turns out you can do it. But essentially, what we did is we told these guys, all right, take enough of what you need for a few days. Leave a lot of the gear on the ridge. We don't expect you to pack it all out. Conserve energy, but take all the fuel, take all the food, take what you need, and we need you to... Here's some GPS coordinates, go there. And they kind of were like, I'm sorry, what do you want us to do now?
Yeah.
So they hiked a couple miles, but they made it down to a river. And it turns out there was I'll call it a landing strip. Really, it was a couple of caribou antlers that had been placed at two different sections that now people land on. Uh-huh. Finally, those guys, they made it down there. They spent another night or two. And by the time a week had elapsed, all of a sudden, people are starting to call in
like,
that are in the Brooks range. Like, so there were some people, legitimately worried, about their situation, calling the different pilots that were sitting there at Kavik saying, you need to pick me up now. I'm running out of food.
So
hunters were calling in, and it was somewhat comical because then the pilots would say, I know he has 80 pounds of sheep meat sitting right next to him. He'll be fine. But there's this feeling of, when the weather is the same over and over again, there's sort of a feeling of maybe it's going to be like this forever.
Right.
And sure enough, after a week, clear blue skies, we jumped in the airplanes. We had actually made two separate attempts to try and get them when the weather would lift up high enough while they were down at the lower elevation. And we would turn the corner around the last range there, turn the corner, fly up the river pretty low, and just it would get too socked in by the time we got there, so we'd have to turn around. So two aborted attempts, and then, like I said, a week, skies opened up, clear blue. We flew over, and, traditionally, one thing that has been, preached to me by those longtime members of the bush community, do a couple of approaches, drag the wheels a couple times, make sure there's nothing surprise. But as we're kind of making our way around doing these approaches, two of the happiest guys I've ever seen on the ground, with their arms raised in the air, shouting and laughing. Yeah, like, what are you doing? We gave them a ham sandwich when they landed, and man, they were the happiest happiest guys I've ever seen. So ended up picking them up out of there. And then flying back to the ridgeline, which again, we had made some rock markers of where to land and where to touch down that were now covered in snow. Kind of took our best guess at, all right, I think it was right about here. And man, it was about the most fun I've had. I've flown F-15s and I've flown F-22s and I have 1,000 hours of Alaska flying time. And the most fun has been in the Super Cub. You just don't do that kind of stuff. But landing the Super Cub, big old tires and 6 inches of snow, sliding to a stop on the top of the ridgeline, throwing everything in the airplane and getting the heck out of there. So,
wow.
So we got everybody taken care of. And
everybody comes. Everybody gets home okay. And one of the things about this story, I think, is that just because you're bored out of your mind and it seems like this is never going to end, don't change your standards, right?
No, absolutely not.
That's sort of like one of the things that got you through is you don't like say, well, we could probably do it.
That attitude, I think, is what gets people hurt, unfortunately. And you just say, hey, let's just do what's safe. Make the right call right now. We know how, this should probably go down. And along the same lines with the equipment type of stuff, we had personal locator beacons. We had a sat phone. We had multiple sat phones. I've got a device that I use in the airplane, which is a GPS receiver, helps me navigate while I'm flying, but also has a transmit function that I can Bluetooth to an iPad and an iPhone, and I can text message anybody that I want through a satellite, which is amazing technology to have, in the Brooks Range.
Multiple backups.
And we used almost all the same on Denali, even with people around, on a popular lot like the West Buttress, we have communication equipment, which in the military you're trained to use, and it's mm-hmm. kind of you're bred and trained to bring that with you almost anytime you go out.
You're part of a larger organization. Yeah.
And so, you know, having that stuff up there, being able to text down and say, hey, I need some help. We don't have any weather reporting mm-hmm. capability up here that we can get a hold of. Can you do me a favor, look through all this mm-hmm. stuff up and give me your best, guess at
hands,
it?
Right?
Yeah. These guys want to know if it's going to stop snowing.
It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth, and we're talking with two officers who are stationed here in Anchorage. That was Air Force Major Matt Miller, who's an F-22 pilot, and he just had this adventure. And I want to talk now with Army Captain Matt Hickey, who led an expedition up Mount McKinley this summer as part of sort of proving the capabilities of the Army and checking the gear. And every expedition up Denali has got adventures, setbacks. Sounds like one of your teams made it, one didn't. What were some of the challenges that you had to overcome?
Well, I kind of want to caveat a little bit with what Major Miller was just talking about, and that sometimes the conditions are going to change, but you can't change the way that you're going to operate just because of that. You're going to go into it knowing that can be the case. And we're trained that in the military, that you have a mission, and then things can go wrong, like the weather or the elements, but you can't just suddenly change. I mean, your plan might change a little bit, but you can't change your procedures because of it. Mm-hmm. And the other team that was on the mountain ran into a large storm at about 11,000 feet, and they were hunkered down for about a week. And during that time, one of their members just happened to get sick and was passing some kidney stones. So now they have some health issues and maybe a little worried about altitude sickness, and the weather's not good. And so they're thinking about, maybe we should try to get down and off the mountain. But the weather was not conducive to traveling at the time, whether it be avalanches or just navigation issues, being in a whiteout. And I got to give a lot of credit to Captain Sam Palmer, who was the leader of that team, made the decision that when the storm was over, he needed to get that guy off the mountain, which seems pretty obvious. But oftentimes when you're on the mountain, all you think about is the summit, mm-hmm. or all you think about is moving a little bit higher up. And it took a lot of courage for him to make the decision that, God, we've trained a long time for this, to try to get to the top of this mountain, but the conditions right now are just not conducive for us to make this happen. And so he decided to abort the summit attempt in order for the safety of the team. And I think that takes not only a lot of courage, but it kind of goes back to your training a lot too. Because mm-hmm. on my expedition, we ran into a lot of weather issues. And we also ran into some conditions on the mountain that provided some challenges. And one of which was when we were descending down a portion of the mountain called Motorcycle Hill, and one of my guys fell into a crevasse. Which is something that you know could happen.
Mm-hmm.
You hope it doesn't, and you darn well better be prepared to get out of it if indeed it does.
And I guess we've got a picture of this on the website.
Yeah,
can check it out.
Yeah.
So alaskapublic.org, look at today's show, Arctic Warriors, and yeah, you can take a look.
So just to speak that a little bit more, you know, in the military, we are prepared to prevent these things before they happen. And we do a lot of risk mitigation before we embark on an operation. So my second in command for this was a guy by the name of Staff Sergeant John Harris, who did a tremendous job training the soldiers when I was taking care of some of the administrative tasks before we set out on the operation. And one of those was crevasse rescue. And so when the individual fell into the crevasse, Specialist Campbell, he immediately fell back on his training, and his rope mate did as well, Staff Sergeant Flynn, who did self-arrest, made sure that Campbell didn't fall further into the crevasse. Mm-hmm. And then once everything was deemed under control, Specialist Campbell used a friction system, a series of Prusik hitches and other such things that we'd trained, that Sergeant Harris had trained them to do, to work his way to the lip of the crevasse, where he was then able to garner some assistance from a guided group that happened to be near us, a mountain trip team, that just kind of gave him a fist, you know, and a hearty handshake, and pulled him out of the last part of the crevasse. So we were thankful for their help. Uh-huh. But you know, we'd fallen back on our training, knowing that something like that could happen. hoping that it wouldn't, but being prepared if it did. Just like if we go over to seas and we could kind of ache in these crevasses to see what IEDs would be like, or these roadside bombs where you hope you don't hit one. You're prepared if you do, and you know what actions to take if indeed it does happen. So so that was certainly a challenge on the mountain. A little bit scary, but it also built confidence in the guys that, hey, what we've been through, our training, it's going to get us through this.
And it
built a lot of confidence, even though it was a little bit scary at the moment, and it helped us further along on the expedition.
So it seems like you've gone, the military has gone through huge change because of all the years of warfare in the Middle East, and then coming back, and we had these constant deployments, and so you weren't able to do as much Arctic training as you did formerly. I remember back in Cold War days, there were these constant troop movements and big training exercises. Mm-hmm. Do you foresee some of that coming back now that the deployments are no longer taking place?
Yes, it's already coming back. A little bit before the show, we were joking around about Alaska. The Army up here used to be called the Hunting and Fishing Brigade, where they would hunt and fish during the summer, and then they would, you know, vigorously train during the wintertime. And while that's, you know, more of a joke than reality, it's because, you know, we do still train during the summers. During the last decade or so, during the War on Terror, we were focused so much on going to Iraq and Afghanistan, and we had rotations down at the National Training Center in California, or the Joint Readiness Training Center in Louisiana, and the units up here were so much in a transitory status, where they were either going to a training site, on a deployment, coming back from a deployment, that they were just never able to hone in on their Arctic and cold weather skills. And now that the tempo of those missions are slowing down overseas in that particular region, at least for the time being.
We hope, right.
We're able to focus a little bit more on our traditional task of being Arctic warriors and being proficient in cold weather environments. And as we all know, up here in Alaska, the Arctic is incredibly important to us as Alaskans in our state, but it's becoming even more important to our country and the world as people are operating in there for commercial purposes. And as soon as all Arctic nations get involved, obviously our Department of Defense is going to look on how do we secure it properly and via the best means. And we all know that the Air Force is playing an active role. I'm sure Major Miller can talk about that a little bit. But in the Navy and the Coast Guard are out on the seas. But at some point, the Army might be called upon to have an established presence in an Arctic environment, whether that's in our state or other Arctic areas, and we need to be ready for that. And I think the training we've been going through, whether it's the airborne unit being able to jump into an Arctic region, whether it's a combat operation or even a humanitarian mission, which the Army's called upon to do quite often, or to transport soldiers on the ground, whether it's tracked vehicles or any other vehicle we might need to use, or a foot march, we're training to be able to accomplish that mission, and if and when we're called upon to do so.
And it seems like, we've got these not hostilities, but sort of aggressive attitude coming from Russia, which really is reminiscent of the Cold War, which was a period when we thought it was possible the Soviet Union could land troops in Alaska, and we had constant intercepts of bombers and all that. From the Air Force perspective, how has this transition happened? Is it been the same thing like it was with the Army, and sort of coming back from a focus on Iraq and Afghanistan and refocusing more on these issues we're talking about?
Yeah, I'd have to say, obviously not near the scope that the Army has played in terms of the roles in Iraq and Afghanistan. But at the same time, our Air Force Arctic warriors in many different career fields, not so much mine specifically, being the F-22 pilot. Mission set is very, 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 finely honed into a specific need for the government. But our C-17 pilots constantly deployed, doing training mission, doing combat missions over there for the last decade. So yes, there is the same kind of, as those begin ramping down, we can now focus elsewhere in the world. Now, C-17 is a global type of mission set. They've been
huge cargo jet.
Yes, sir. Most recently helping with the Ebola crisis. over in Africa. So, I mean, the amount of mission sets, humanitarian, et cetera, that those guys do is near limitless, mm-hmm. I think, and worldwide. So the drawdown there has let them...
You guys kind of never know where you're going to be sent, right?
That's right.
You could be anywhere.
That's right. And we oftentimes, even from the fighter perspective, will constantly... go from Alaska into different environments. You know, most recently we've been back and forth to the desert as well, the United Arab Emirates, and in other places in the Pacific as well, doing different training exercises, working with coalition partners and stuff like that to train not only here but elsewhere. So we really have to be at a moment's notice ready to go fight in any environment the world has to offer.
Wow. So, I mean, this is why you need to train all the time, because you never know what you run into.
You do, and we, you know, the Army and the Air Force share a really special relationship mm-hmm. In that a recent training exercise that the Army and Air Force both conducted was actually a partnered one with the Thai Army. The paratroopers up here in Alaska rigged up, loaded a C-17 or a few C-17s, flown obviously by our Air Force brethren, and flew across the Pacific Ocean, jumped into Thailand, conducted an operation in the jungle for about 3 days, reloaded the C-17s in Thailand, flew back across the Pacific all the way to Alaska, and jumped into the interior Alaska in an Arctic environment and conducted an operation afterwards. And this was all within 1 week. And the Air Force helped the units get there. The Army obviously conducted the operations on the ground. But the challenges that the Army faces in these environments, whether it's on the, you know, on the ground in Thailand or on the ground in Alaska, these aircraft still in the crew and the airmen mm-hmm. that have to operate
same
those,
people. Yeah,
you know, we're all wearing uniforms, we're all working mm-hmm. together, and we all face some of the same challenges, whether it's the heat or the cold
snakes or frostbite.
Yeah, snakes, grizzly bears, you name it.
Not sure which is worse.
So
we're almost out of time, but we have some. You know, I think we have the highest per capita of veterans in Alaska because people come here, they get transferred all around the world, and they stay. You guys sound like you might end up staying when your careers are over. What do you think?
Well, I could, yes. This is a very unique place, and just like the military is a unique community where you meet some fascinating individuals with some great stories, Alaska shares a lot of those same values in that people want to have interesting lives and they want to have mm-hmm. a community.
And you've got all these skills now, right?
You've got a lot of skills, and like Major Miller said, with the aviation community, that exists very largely here in Alaska, and you know, there's a lot of mountain climbers here in Alaska. Mm-hmm. So I reached out to many of them before we went out, because there's a lot of knowledge to be had. And so mm-hmm. Alaska is an incredible place that I could totally see myself being at some point in the future for a long time.
And I'll tell you real quick, my wife, I told her, she is a pure Southerner, born and raised, and I said, I know a lot of things, but I've already been stationed in Alaska, so they won't send me back. And then they sent me back, and she cried, and now she can't imagine leaving.
Oh, good. Yeah. Well, we've got a lot of Southerners here, too.
Yeah.
Well, this has been really interesting. I want to thank both of my guests, Captain Matt Hickey of the U.S. Army. He led that expedition up Denali this year. Major Matt Miller, an F-22 pilot with the 90th Fighter Squadron, U.S. Air Force. Thanks both.
Thanks for
you.
Having us.
Really
thank
interesting.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
Join me again next week. We're going to be talking about trapping. This is an outdoor activity that has been a staple of Alaska's history, and people are still doing it for recreation and for their work. So trapping next week on Outdoor Explorer. Thanks for joining us today. Our producer is Monica Gokey. I'm your host, Charles Wolforth, and I'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and on iTunes. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life informed. This is Alaska Public Media.